The people in Zimbabwe are waiting. It's been 18 days since they voted in a national election, and still the government is holding back the results. Dewa Mavinga is a human rights lawyer who has seen firsthand what the government can do, will do, to its opponents.
I was part of a group of young men who were marching into the capital city to demand that the government should be dissolved and that we should have human rights and democracy in Zimbabwe. I was caught by the army, and they began to beat me with clenched fists. They were using baton sticks and whatever weapons that they could lay their hands on.
Dewa Mavinga was back in Zimbabwe last month. He says he's never seen the country in such dire shape. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
The unofficial results from the Zimbabwe election show that Robert Mugabe's ruling party has lost its parliamentary majority. But that party in power is making no concessions. Instead, they're stalling, demanding recounts. Mugabe has ruled Zimbabwe now for 28 years. His country is in economic ruin. I talked about that with a Zimbabwean human rights lawyer. Dewa Mavinga lives in London, but he goes back to Zimbabwe whenever he can. He flew into the capital, Harare, just last month.
What struck me most as I got to the airport was the desolation. It was quiet and deserted. I could really feel that things were not well. As I got into the capital city, there was evidence of a lot of suffering. A lot of people were queuing for basic things like bread. And I could not, on the first day that I arrived, get a Coca-Cola drink, which is something that used to be available in abundance, but I could not get it anywhere in town. Neither would we get bread for that day.
Dewa's family is emblematic of Zimbabwe today. 8 children in his family, 6 living outside the country. There are just no jobs. His brother and sister, who remain at home with his parents, are simply too young to leave. This past month, Dewa was on his way home for a visit at the family farm. But he was struck by what he saw in the city. Long lines of people trying to buy food.
It's not only that there is no food in the shops. I tried to get lunch in town, but we spent about 3 hours with my colleagues trying to find a place where we could get lunch. We were moving from one restaurant to the other, finding them closed and shut down and without anything to offer. And eventually, when we did find somewhere to have a meal, I ordered a cheeseburger. And when it was delivered to me, it was just bread and cheese. And I tried to ask, what about the meat that is supposed to go with the burger, if it is called a burger? But they were saying they'd run out of that, and for 2 weeks they'd been serving just a piece of cheese and bread, and that is what they called the cheeseburger, and there were no drinks at that place.
Tell me something, Dewa. The number of restaurants you saw that were closed, could that be explained by people who were just afraid to open because of the possibility of violence in the city after the election? Or do you believe that it was really just because there's no food there?
It is basically because there is no food.
On his ride home, Dewa saw more lines of people waiting to buy bread, waiting to grind their cornmeal. There was no food to buy along the way either. Then he arrived at his parents' farm.
There was the happiness that I had. I was really happy to be home and to be with my family. But immediately I was also struck by the depth of poverty and suffering that was there. My father had been unwell for some time, and when I saw him, his condition was not very good. And he had gone through a very difficult time because the hospitals do not have any drugs and medication. And we had tried to raise money to send for him to be taken to hospital, but the hospitals did not have any medication for him, and his situation was deteriorating. We got to a point where we were even asked by the hospital that if we are to have any blood transfusion, they recommended we go and buy in South Africa and then bring the pints of blood that he can be given more blood.
And was it possible for you to bring any medicine with you from the UK when you flew in?
It was not possible, because this is one of the key things that the government has stopped, that it's no longer possible for anyone to bring any medication or drugs into Zimbabwe other than by means of smuggling. And smuggling is mainly done when you cross on foot from South Africa. And this is where we have a thriving trade of people bringing in drugs, particularly antiretroviral drugs for HIV/AIDS patients.
Did you think about bringing something from London?
Yes, I actually had asked around to find out if I could bring any medicines for him, but it was not possible, especially as I was going to go to Harare International Airport and not to get in on foot.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Dewa Mavinga has one brother and one sister who still live at the family home in Zimbabwe. His youngest brother should be in the local primary school, but the teachers there have quit. The only one left is the headmaster. The family tried another school in the city.
But when we transferred him halfway through the school term to the capital city, we still face the same problem that even in Harare, the teachers are no longer in schools. They have all left. And for the sister who is at a boarding school, maybe 250 kilometers from Harare, there is also the same problem that three quarters of the teachers at the school have left. And so hardly any lessons are taking place in that environment. And most of the times they are on strike or they are not attending lessons at all.
Maybe the answer to this one is something obvious that I'm missing, but why are all the teachers leaving?
Their salaries are so low that a teacher's salary would not be enough to buy 10 loaves of bread because of the inflation that we are experiencing in Zimbabwe, which now is over 165,000%. So what it means is that a teacher's salary would be so low that to buy and sell things on the streets or to leave the country would be far much better than to continue in the profession.
Now, your mother and father and brother and sister are still living on the family farm in Chebu, is that right?
That is correct.
So are they able to grow the food that they need to be comfortable or to get by?
Yes, they are able to grow the food. But now the problem is that a lot of people, the extended family, everyone is now relying on the farm for assistance in terms of food as well. And also, in the times past, the family would be able to sell the food and get money to buy other things. Now, because of inflation, the money that is received from selling part of the maize crop is not enough to make any difference at all, such that now we are only growing food for the family.
So what's missing in your mother's kitchen?
In fact, I would say basically everything is missing. What we go by now is just the staple diet of mealie meal. That is the flour that is made from maize, or is it corn in the U.S.?
Right, and it's cooked as a form of bread, is that right?
Yes, it's made into a thick porridge. That is the staple diet. But it used to be the case that in a typical family, people would have breakfast, would have lunch, and then would have supper in the evening. But now we all rely on one meal per day, supper only.
So it's hard then to get cooking oil, salt, sugar, that sort of thing?
You can only get cooking oil in South Africa or surrounding countries. Even salt is also a scarcity now. So you'd have a meal without the basics like salt.
And so when you visit the farm now, Dewa, what are those striking differences you see from a few months ago or a few years ago when you were living there yourself?
I think it's just that everything has gone down in the sense that even a few years ago we had as many as 80 cattle. Now we have less than 10 because for every problem that now arises, my father had to sell a beast to send my brothers to school, to send my sisters to school.
It's kind of like your father's savings account then. When he needs money, he sells a cow.
Yes, absolutely. But now it's completely depleted. He has now less than 10 beef cattle.
Dewa Mavinga told me that the biggest change he noticed was not the poverty or the lack of health care or education, but it was in the political attitude that he found in his own family. His mother was a young woman when Zimbabwe got its independence. That was almost 30 years ago. And though she's had the chance in the past, Dewa says his mother has never bothered to vote. This time, for this election, she changed her mind.
All along, my mother had been saying that politics is for men or for those in the cities who should decide how the country is governed. But when I spoke to her last March when I was in Zimbabwe, she was saying this time around she would want to cast a vote and make a difference because she had suffered so much that she really wants to make sure that at least something is done about change of governance in Zimbabwe.
You know, what surprises me about that is that that people would believe that by casting a vote they could make a difference? I mean, Mugabe's been in power now for almost 30 years, and every time someone wants to challenge him, they get thrown in jail or they get in trouble. Why is it that your mother would have faith in the, you know, the ability to change things through a vote?
I think it's basically because one of the ways in which the government had always returned to power was by coercing people to vote for it or by intimidating people not to go and vote. And therefore, for my mother and others, their understanding was that it was because people did not go and vote. And so the belief was that if they go in their numbers to vote, then that would make a difference and that Mugabe would be defeated.
The election itself would have taken place after you left Zimbabwe, is that right?
That is correct.
Did you talk to your mother afterwards?
Yes, she was. She kept repeating that she was determined to make a difference and she was determined to ensure that your vote is counted and makes a difference.
Dewa's mother still doesn't know if her vote has made a difference. As I mentioned earlier, it's been 18 days since the election, and the government of Robert Mugabe has still not released the results. Dewa Mavinga first got involved in politics himself when he was a student at the University of Zimbabwe, and even then it put him in some danger.
A number of times, particularly my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, would discourage me from being actively involved in politics, especially in 2001 when a student was beaten to death by the police. So a lot of people were saying, look what happens to students, activists, and it was a very difficult time for me.
Dewa knew that student who was beaten to death, and he kept on with his own work as an activist anyway. And I'll talk more with him about his own actions and clashes with the authorities in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. People in Zimbabwe are still waiting for the results of the election that they held 2.5 weeks ago. And many are hoping that this time the votes will mean the end of 28 years in power for Robert Mugabe. His country is such an economic mess, it's reported that a quarter of the population of the country has left. Dewa Mavinga is a human rights lawyer in London who's also watching events in Zimbabwe. He has parents, siblings, and close friends still living there. Dewa says his own political activism began when he was in university. He says he knew he couldn't quit when police tracked a fellow activist into his dorm and beat him to death.
I knew him. He was a quiet young man who was just caught up in the crossfire and was unfortunately beaten to death. I was called around 2 a.m. in the morning by other students to say that there is a student who is being beaten in one of the halls of residence for students. And when we got to the scene, he had already died.
And who had beaten him?
It was the riot police, which is a crack unit of the Zimbabwe Republic Police, which had come to the university to deal with disturbances that they said were being perpetrated by students.
Can you remember what it was like in that hallway that evening?
It was filled with tear smoke. They had thrown canisters of tear gas to disperse students, and there was blood and destruction. A lot of rooms had been bent down and broken down as they were breaking to enter into students' rooms. So there was really utter chaos and mayhem. And also it was deserted because all students then fled and into the night and left the university.
What were you thinking?
I was really devastated, and for the first time I really felt deep anger and bitterness against the government, which I so clearly was responsible for that heartless and cold-blooded murder of a young student who was an orphan. And I felt in my heart that I could not bring myself to forgive such an act of brutality.
Was there ever any investigation of that? Did anyone ever get taken before a court for the death of that student?
Yes, there was an investigation. Unfortunately, what happened was that after we took this student to bury him in the rural areas, we came back into the capital city and decided to march peacefully to demonstrate against police brutality. And in that demonstration, the police again opened fire on students and several were injured and hurt. And then we took the matter to the magistrate's court, where a magistrate held an inquest into the murder of the student and found that the police are liable for the murder of the student and that the Minister of Home Affairs should be held responsible. Unfortunately, nothing has been done to bring individual perpetrators of this crime to book. So this is one of the many issues of crime that are yet to address in a free Zimbabwe.
You had mentioned to me earlier that your grandmother told you at that time, Dewa, get out of student politics. It's too dangerous. What did she say to you? Was she able to persuade you at all?
She did say to me that you should look to your family. You are the second born child. You have six children coming after you that you must take care of, and you must also take care of your parents. So you must think about that, and you should look at the investment that your father, even in his old age, has put into you. Everyone is looking up to you. So you should desist from engaging in these political things. But at that point, I was so hurt, and I was saying to myself that the fight for justice is really the investment that my parents have made in me, that alone should be enough to push me. So I was saying to myself that if I then just focus on my family and my security, then I would have let down the student who has died. I kept saying to myself that this young student should not die in vain. I would have let down also the community that really still, even today, is still fighting for justice and human rights.
Yeah, but to make a pledge like that, though, was to put yourself at some risk.
Yes, but if you are living in a society and community like Zimbabwe, you would come to a point where you would have to make choices and decisions, and to know that really there is no way that we are going to get democracy and human rights on a silver platter. So I made a conscious decision that, yes, this is not going to be easy, but someone has to make those sacrifices. And for this cause that I believe in, and alone for the cause, I would be prepared to put my life on the line and to go for what I believe in.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Dewa Mavinga put that pledge to the test not long after he made it.
I receive threats to my life almost on a daily basis. I've been arrested a number of times, and I've spent a number of days in the government's prisons. One time in 2003, I was beaten so much that the soldier who was beating me assumed that I had died when I passed out.
Dewa says it happened on a day when he joined an opposition party's call to march.
The opposition movement for democratic change had called for a final push of protests to force the government out of power. And the police and the army were deployed into high-density township in Harare. And I was part of a group of young men who were marching into the capital city to demand that the government should be dissolved and that we should have human rights and democracy in Zimbabwe. I was caught by the army, and they began to beat me with clenched fists. They were using button sticks and whatever weapons that they could lay their hands on. And this went on for a long time, and then we were put in a police camp, and they continued to beat us until midday, where they started in the morning. And then they took us to Harare Central Police Station, where we were kept in cells, 100 people in one big cell. I was suffering a bit from concussion after they beat me on the head.
And how long were you kept?
We stayed in the cells for 8 days and eight nights.
A few years ago, an international charity awarded Dewa Mavinga a scholarship to study abroad in safety. He went to Britain and studied human rights and law. He now lives in London, but he says he returns regularly to work in Zimbabwe, and he still gets in trouble with the authorities.
I was back in Zimbabwe, and we were having a seminar on human rights in one small city called Gweru, teaching university students human rights, students' rights. And then it was on a weekend, on a Saturday. The police came to the meeting. They arrested all the presenters, myself included, who were taken to a police station in Gweru and interrogated for more than 5 hours. And then we were told that we could not leave the city on the Saturday. And then the following Sunday, we were told never to teach human rights again in Zimbabwe, and that on that occasion, they had not beaten us simply because they were too committed with their work elsewhere. But we seriously want never to do human rights work in Zimbabwe.
You know, all the time that Mugabe has been in power, he has said publicly that, you know, he will abide by rule of law, at least to a certain extent. How could someone say to you that it's illegal to teach human rights in Zimbabwe? What excuse could they come up with for saying that?
The police officers were saying to us that they did not need to explain themselves at all to us, and that as far as they were concerned, human rights was not a local concept that we could teach. It was a Western idea which was there to encourage people to rebel against a legitimate government.
I have to wonder what someone like you thinks when you read in the paper, and you would have read it this past weekend as I did, you know, South Africa's president meets with President Mugabe of Zimbabwe and they come out to meet the cameras, they're holding hands, and Mbeki says, there's no political crisis here, everything is unfolding as it should. What do you think when you see that?
It really fills me with a lot of sadness and makes me at times even to think that I'm losing hope. But what gives me hope is that even in South Africa, the people are now aware that there is a serious crisis in Zimbabwe. The whole region now understands that Zimbabwe is going through a serious constitutional crisis.
You've got a brother in South Africa. How's he doing?
He is not doing very well. He's going through a very difficult time. He is the eldest in the family. In Zimbabwe, he was working for as an accountant. He had to leave because of the difficulties that his salary was really a pittance and could not make a difference, and he had to move to South Africa. When he moved to South Africa, he could not get a work permit, so he could not get a job within a bank or as an accountant. So he ended up teaching night schools and small colleges, private colleges. At times, he is not paid. Or he goes 3 months without a salary and cannot go to any labor tribunal or to any court because he is an illegal immigrant in South Africa. And therefore, to go to those courts would immediately mean that he will be deported back to Zimbabwe.
It's been hard for Dewo Mavhinga as well, waiting to see if the election results are released and if they're respected. For now, he's staying at his home in London, getting news from the BBC, like this recent report about the opposition supporters standing up to the government.
That they came here at all is a sign of one thing, that Zimbabwe's crisis is now theirs too. It is dragging the entire southern African region in its downward spiral.
I have not been able to get through to my mother the whole week. It's very difficult to connect to cell phones in Zimbabwe, and there's been speculation that perhaps the networks are being jammed by the state, and even the times that I managed to get through, it's not very easy to talk freely over the phone. So the only thing to do would be to make arrangements to actually find myself in the country to be with my mother.
Why doesn't she leave? Why don't your parents leave?
Zimbabwe is their home, and they say this is home. They are too old to start a new life in any other country. So they are there, and they are just hoping and praying that life changes for the better in their old age.
I wonder, Dewa, if it's hard for you, knowing that they are there and living that kind of life, or even, in fact, if you feel guilty because you have a higher quality of life in London, as I'm sure some other brothers and sisters do, simply because they're outside Zimbabwe.
Yes, I really feel bad about it, especially when I know that I have access to 3 meals a day. This is why I'm saying that I'm committed to fighting for human rights in Zimbabwe. My heart is in Zimbabwe, and all my work and effort would go into making Zimbabwe a democracy, a working democracy again.
Can you imagine any set of circumstances where you'd get a chance to move back to Zimbabwe, where you'd make your home there again?
As soon as we have a new government that is legitimate and that is respectful of the wishes and the will of the people, I would find myself back in Zimbabwe and also supporting my colleagues, all the millions of Zimbabweans in the diaspora, to go back home to build our country again.
You'd go back, no hesitation?
Not at all.
And yet here we are, it's been more than 2 weeks since the people in the country voted, and there's no word about who the winner is, or the results aren't going to be released. I wonder if we're headed into another long period of time when Mugabe just retains power.
There is that possibility, but My belief is that this is the end. We are coming to the end of Mugabe's regime. There is a sense within the people, be they policemen, the army or civil servants or ordinary people in Zimbabwe, that enough is enough, that we need a time now, which is after Mugabe. Without Mugabe, we need to move on as a country without Mugabe. I sincerely believe that we have come to the end of the road for Mugabe.
It's interesting to hear you say that because, you know, he has, despite all odds, hung on to power so many times for so many years, and yet you're saying at this point you think he's finally at the end of his time as leader there. Are you saying to me that this is a time of hope for you and others who are there?
Absolutely, absolutely. If you look at the elections results that were announced so far, for the first time since 1980 when we gained independence, ZANU-PF, his party, has lost the majority in parliament. And even if he declares himself winner, it will not be easy for the country to accept. It's just not possible when there is no bread. Things are so bad in Zimbabwe that it is not conceivable and it is not possible that we would have Mugabe for another 5 years.
Dewa Mavinga talked with me from a BBC studio in London. He now works for the Zimbabwean Human Rights NGO Forum. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Today is something of an anniversary here in this country in the struggle for self-determination. It was 61 years ago today that the Brooklyn Dodgers sent an African-American baseball player to man first base in a major league game. His name was Jackie Robinson, and it wasn't long before number 42 made his mark as a batter, a fielder, and a base runner.
The windup, and here comes Robinson, trying to steal home. He's safe, says the ump. He's out, says Yogi Berra, and brother is Yogi hopping. And so the opening game ends with the Yankees winning 6-5. Berra still saying he was out, and Dodger fans rather mournfully saying, "Wait till tomorrow."
Well, I got a letter a little while back from Ron Rabinowitz with a story about the way that Jackie Robinson changed his life. It all began when little Ronnie was all of 7 years old and living in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. His dad was a civil rights lawyer who admired the Dodgers for giving Jackie Robinson the chance to play Major League ball.
I remember one time he went to New York on business, and he said that he had gone to see the Dodgers at Ebbets Field, and I thought, oh my God, I'm so jealous. I wish it was me. And he said, how would you like someday to maybe get an autograph from Jackie or maybe meet him? And I said, oh, my God, that would be thrilling. And my dad wrote Jackie a letter and told him how much I admired him.
But these guys get so many fan letters. I mean, did you really expect to hear back from Jackie Robinson?
No. As a matter of fact, I don't even know if I remember if my dad had told me that he had written to him.
Yeah.
I think he didn't want to tell me in case I would be disappointed.
But the letter came and it was addressed to you.
Right? Yes. Yeah. Can you imagine? So here I come home from school one day, and I walk into my room, and there laying on my bed is a letter. It's addressed to me, and it says Jackie Robinson on it. And I went crazy, and I quick ran to the kitchen to tell my mom, and I was so thrilled. And then I ran back to my room to open the letter, and as I turned over my shoulder, she was standing in the doorway watching with a big smile on her face. And of course, after I read the letter, I called my dad at his office, and I was so thrilled.
Now, what had Jackie Robinson said in the letter, Ron?
He had sent me an autographed picture, and he said, to Ronald, best of luck always, Jackie Robinson. And then he would love to meet me sometime when the Dodgers are playing in Milwaukee.
And this was written out in longhand. It wasn't some form letter.
In longhand, exactly. Yeah.
So yeah. I bet the next time the Dodgers came to town, you and your dad were sure to get tickets.
We sure did. My dad got tickets on the third base side, the box seats, near the Dodger dugout. So we used to go early to watch batting practice. And I walked down to the gate to watch the ball players, and I'm looking for Jackie, and all of a sudden I spotted him. He was doing laps of the outfield. And I thought, oh, my God. And then after the game, you know how kids are, get pretty impatient. And it takes 45 minutes to an hour before ballplayers start coming out.
Oh, you're waiting for an autograph, right? You're lined up with all the other kids.
I was waiting with about 50 other kids. And every time a ballplayer came out, all the kids would run after him, you know. And I didn't move. I just waited because I was waiting for one person. And then when he came out, I ran up to him with these other kids that were there. And I said, Jackie, I'm Ronnie Rabinowitz. Do you remember me? And he says, sure I do. And my dad standing over my shoulder, he says, sure, Jackie, with the thousands of letters you get, how would you remember? And he says, no, I remember your dad wrote me on lawyer stationery.
It was the beginning of a most unusual friendship between the legendary ballplayer and the kid from Wisconsin. I'll talk more with Ronnie Rabinowitz in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. April 15th, 1947. It was 61 years ago today that Jackie Robinson slipped on the uniform of the Brooklyn Dodgers and stepped into history as the first African-American to play in the major leagues. It was some time later, in the 1950s, when Robinson befriended this wide-eyed kid from Sheboygan, Wisconsin, Ronnie Rabinowitz. Ronnie's dad had written a letter to the baseball star on behalf of his 7-year-old son, and Ron remembers the moment that he was actually recognized by Jackie Robinson. It happened outside the Dodgers' locker room when the team was in town for a game against the Braves.
Well, you know, at that time, Dick, I actually didn't even get his autograph. I just wanted to be with him and walk with him as he was walking back to the team bus. And other kids, he was signing other kids' autographs, and he was talking to me. And as he got to the bus, he said, keep in touch, you know. And I thought, oh, my God, Jackie Robinson's telling me to keep in touch. So I wrote him a letter, and I told him what I'm doing in school and how much I loved meeting him. And lo and behold, it wasn't long after that, I got a letter back from him. You know, I'd go to school and I'd tell my friends, well, I might be getting another letter from Jackie. Yeah, sure, you're going to get a letter from me. I'm going to get a letter from Donald Duck, you know. And then I'd get this letter and I'd bring it to school, and all these kids were so thrilled. I mean, it was like they couldn't believe it.
He was good with kids, right? Good with autographs?
He was great with kids. I can tell you a story, Dick. One time he came out of the dressing room and the team was going back to the hotel after the game. And they were going back to the bus, and I was talking to him. And again, he was signing autographs. And pretty soon, here comes a priest with a whole parish full of kids. And they all want autographs. So he's standing there signing all these autographs. Pretty soon, one of the windows on the bus are opening, and these guys are, come on, Jackie, you're holding us up. So he goes to the bus driver, and he says, you know what? Take the guys back to the hotel. I'll take a cab. And he stood there, and he signed every kid's autograph. And, of course, he didn't have to take a cab. We gave him a ride, but that's the type of guy he was.
He played from, what, the mid-1940s to the mid-1950s?
1947 to 56. Yeah, he was actually 28 years old when he was a rookie, which is, of course, awfully old for a rookie.
Now, did he ever take you inside the dressing room?
Yeah, he sure did. You know, it's amazing. It's as I was saying, how impatient kids can get, and you're waiting for these ballplayers to come out, and people would go in like a guy with a suit on or something, and I'd say to my dad, I'd say, who are those people? How come they get in there? He said, well, they're reporters. And I said, boy, I want to be a reporter when I grow up. So there was a sign on the dressing room door, Dick, that said, warning, do not enter, trespassing, you could go to jail, and all this stuff, and legal jargon. We used to read that over and over just to kill time because there was nothing else to do. So one day he comes out of the dressing room and he points to me and he says, come here. And he takes me by the hand and he takes me into the dressing room. And I said to him, oh, my gosh, I'm going to jail. And he started to chuckle. He says, no, no, you're fine. You don't have to worry. You're with me.
You were what, 8, 9 years old at the time?
I was about 9 or 10 years old, yeah.
Okay.
So he takes a ball out of a bag, brand new ball, and he takes me from locker to locker to locker to all my heroes. Here's Roy Campanella in his shorts, Duke Snider, Pee Wee Reese, Carl Furillo, Don Newcomb. Sandy Koufax was a rookie that year. I mean, every one of the Dodgers signed this ball. I mean, I was on cloud nine.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, it was so funny. He was so interested in helping me get these autographs that he forgot to sign the ball himself, which was fine. I've got many other autographs.
So, you know, what would you do with a ball like that? Would you take it to your father and say, lock it in the lawyer's safe, Dad?
You know what we did as kids? We used to play with these balls, Dick. I mean, you wouldn't do it today. We played catch with them. We had grass stains on them.
It was
goofy. Today you wouldn't touch those. It was a whole different time then.
But have you still got a file of the letters, and have you still got the baseballs?
Oh, yes, I sure do. I sure do. Absolutely.
What would you guys write about?
Oh, I would write to him and tell him what I was doing in school, and he would write back to me and tell me what his kids were doing. His oldest son, Jackie Jr., was about a year younger than I was. So we had a lot of similar interests. I was playing Little League ball. He was playing Little League ball. I was going to camp. He was going to camp. That's the type of guy he was. He was first class.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. So year after year, Ron Rabinowitz is exchanging these letters with the baseball player Jackie Robinson. Turns out that Robinson was quite upfront with both Ron and Ron's dad, the civil rights lawyer, on issues of politics and the racism of the day.
He used to write to my dad in the letters to me, tell your dad that Stevenson would have fared better had the war not erupted, and I think we'll be okay with Ike. And then he would write one time, the Republicans have made me a Democrat, and he was a Republican, which was unusual at that time.
Yeah, it was around the time when things were starting to switch, right?
Right.
I'm curious about something else. I mean, we speak with such affection today about Jackie Robinson, but we are talking about a time in the early 1950s when there was a lot more public racism in this country than we see today. Did anybody ever give you a hard time?
I did have an incident that happened after he had retired from baseball. He came back to Manitowoc, Wisconsin, to speak, and we had made arrangements that he was going to stay overnight the next day. So a few weeks before that, my dad and I are out on the front lawn. We're playing catch, and the neighbor walks by. My dad tells him that Jackie Robinson's going to be coming to our house. He looked at my dad, and he says, "You mean to tell me you would let Jackie Robinson sleep in your house?" He says, "Of course I would. I'd love to have him build a house next to me." And he says, "Boy, I sure wouldn't." My dad looked him right in the eye and he said, "You know, I don't think that would be the real question. I think the real question would be whether Jackie Robinson would want to live next to you." So we met Jackie in Manitowoc. He was presented with the key to the city by the mayor. Big skeleton key that was red, white, and blue ribbons on it. So we're driving him back to the airport after the event, and he has this key on his lap, and I'm sitting next to him, and he turns to me, and he says, "Ronnie," he says, "why don't you keep this for me, would you?" And he gave me the key, and I thought, oh, my goodness. So on the way home, we stopped, and my dad had to go to his law office for something. So we drive up to the law office, and there's a sign that someone had spray-painted on the front of my dad's office, "Rabinowitz is bringing niggers to Sheboygan." And I started to cry. I was just devastated. My mom, my sister, my dad, and I, we got out of the car. We got some rags and brushes and water and soap, and we, as a family, scrubbed it down.
As you got older, did you and Jackie Robinson ever talk about the kind of racism that he faced?
Sure we did. He was speaking in Birmingham, Alabama. Then he was coming to Milwaukee to speak, and we met him at the airport. He was quite disturbed. As he came off the plane, he was telling me an incident that happened after his speech in Birmingham. He went back to the airport to wait for his plane, and there was a sign in the waiting room that said, "Whites only." And he sat down, and the police came, and they were going to arrest him. Then they found out he was Jackie Robinson. They let him go. But, you know, he was very disturbed, and he said, "Ronnie, if my name would have been Paul Jones or John Smith or anybody else, I'd be in jail today for the color of my skin. That's something we have to change."
And did the two of you ever compare notes about growing up Jewish in America as opposed to growing up black in America? I mean, was there any kind of parallel that you two shared on that level?
There was, Dick. We were so different. I mean, I was white, he was black, I was Jewish, he was Christian. I was a kid, he was an adult. I was from a small town in the Midwest, he was from out east. And yet there was this bond, this friendship. We had racism in Sheboygan. It was more or less an unwritten rule at that time that African Americans, if they were entertainers, for instance, they could perform, but they had to move on. They couldn't stay overnight. There was racism about Jews in Sheboygan. I had a friend, Johnny, who I grew up with, and he told me one day, he says, "I can't play with you anymore. We're playing in the playground." I says, "Why?" He says, "Because you're Jewish." And I went home and I cried. I was just devastated. And that night, my dad went over to their home and talked to his parents. I wasn't there. I don't know what was said. But the next day, we were able to play together again. And I brought him to meet Jackie Robinson, and Jackie Robinson became his hero, too.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. I'm talking with Ron Rabinowitz about his lifelong friendship with the baseball player Jackie Robinson. Ron says that near the end of the ball player's career, he was among the first to get a hint that Robinson was ready to retire.
In this particular game, he was playing left field. And a line drive went by him and rolled all the way to the fence. And after the game, we had dinner with him in Milwaukee, and I said, "Jackie, that was a tough play." He says, "Tough heck." He says, "Amoros would have had it. Sandy Amoros was a rookie left fielder." And he said, "Ronnie," he says, "my legs are gone. If I had to do it over, I wouldn't have played all the sports I did." Huh. You know, he was a natural athlete. At UCLA, he was the All-American in football. He was an All-American in basketball. He broke the world's record in the broad jump and track, and he played baseball. And he says, "I'm going to tell you a secret that no one else knows except my own family." He says, "I think next year is going to be my last year in baseball." And in fact, it was. Oh, when he announced his retirement, I cried. I was just devastated. And I wrote him about it, and he told me that his own son, Jackie Jr., was crying too. And he assured both of us that everything would be okay. And in fact, it was, because he did come back to Wisconsin many, many times.
When you think back to the friendship that you shared with Jackie Robinson, this big age difference that you were talking about, did you learn something about that man that the rest of us might not know?
Yeah, I did, Dick. You know, as I grew up, I realized how much more than baseball he was. My God, he changed this world, and he did it alone. There was no civil rights movement. There was no Martin Luther King. There was no Rosa Parks. He did it all alone. Martin Luther King was maybe 12 or 13 years old at this time, and the abuse he took was tremendous. So I realized what this man did, opening up doors, not only in the sports world, but in the business world and other avenues. He was just a magnificent human being.
Do you think that he was aware of the kind of change that he was bringing about, or was he more focused on baseball and, you know, making it through a season, that sort of thing?
Oh, I think he knew. He knew. I'll tell you, the first couple years, he couldn't fight back. He couldn't say anything. And Branch Rickey, who was a genius, to pick Jackie, because there could have been other ball players that would have failed this experiment. You know, here you're sliding into second base. You reach for the bag, and the shortstop or the second baseman stamps on your hand and says, "Take that, black boy." And, you know, in those days, the spikes were a lot sharper than they are today. I mean, the ball players used to actually file them to get better grips when they're running. So blood would be squirting out of his hand, and I mean, anybody else would have got up and popped this guy, you know. But he knew he couldn't do that, because that's what the bigots wanted. They wanted him to start trouble, and then they would have said, "See, he's nothing but trouble, get him out of here." So the only way he could fight back was by stealing a base, hitting a home run, helping his Dodgers win. And that's how he did it. His own teammates at the time didn't want to play with him when he first came up. Dixie Walker was one of the stars on the Dodgers. Dixie Walker was from the South. And he said, "How can I go back home? They'll kill me back there if they know I'm playing with a black man."
Yeah.
So this man went through, he was very lonely. He couldn't sleep with his team, couldn't eat with his team. It was amazing. And then after a couple of years, Roy Campanella, Don Newcomb, Joe Black came to be, and he told me a story one time where he was in St. Louis, and they were at the Chase Hotel, and they couldn't stay with their team. So the four of them went to the general manager and said, "Why can't we stay with our team?" And he says, "Okay, I'll agree to let you guys stay if you promise not to use our swimming pool." I mean, just ridiculous.
It was, I think, 1972 when Jackie Robinson died. When was the last time you saw him?
I saw him about 6 months before he passed away, Dick. His health had been failing. He had had a heart attack. He had suffered from diabetes for several years. He was blind in one eye, and he was going blind in the other eye. And I met him for lunch in New York I had to help him down two steps into this restaurant. I had to take him by the arm, and it was so sad because I knew he was ill, and it flashed in my mind envisioning him, you know, jumping up and down on first base, driving those pitchers crazy, and then sliding into second and stealing third and stealing home. And now I was helping him. Mm-hmm. And after lunch, I helped him get a cab. I got him settled in the cab, and I leaned in, and I kissed him on the cheek, and I told him I loved him. And that was the last time I ever saw him.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Ron Rabinowitz had the most unusual experience, the kind of thing that is increasingly less likely to happen these days. When Ron was just a kid, he was a baseball fan, and he went on to become good friends with the great player Jackie Robinson.
I often wondered, why me? And I don't know the answer to that, Dick. He had given me his unlisted phone number in Stamford, Connecticut, and I never abused it. I never asked for anything. I never said, give me an autograph, give me. I got all those things, but I never begged or never asked for any of it. He just gave it to me.
You think your friendship with Jackie Robinson changed you in any way?
I think it did. He was my hero. As a kid, you know, he was helping my Dodgers win, and that was it. But he showed me to be true to myself. I can read to you one of these letters that he wrote to me. Dear Ronnie, it was good to hear from you again. I hope everyone is fine at home. It looks as if the Dodgers have blown their chance. This was in August of 57. You are very kind to say the nice things you did. I learned a long time ago that a person must be true to himself if he is to succeed. He must be willing to stand by his principles, even at a possible loss of prestige. He must first learn to live with himself before he can hope to live with others. I have been fortunate. God has been good to me, and I intend to work as hard as I can to repay all the things people have done for me. I appreciate your friendship and feel as long as you set worthwhile goals and head for them, you will do well. Continued good luck. Give my regards to the family. Always, Jackie. Amazing.
Promise me, Ron. Promise me I'll never see that on eBay.
You never will. As long as I'm alive, you will never see that on eBay. I wouldn't sell that for anything. Here's another one. I had invited him to my bar mitzvah. And he apologized. He couldn't come and whatever. And he wrote me in October of 58. My bar mitzvah was in October of 58. And he says, I'm happy to know everything went well at your bar mitzvah. My schedule has been so busy, I've not been able to keep up with my outside responsibilities. It doesn't seem like I'll be getting to Sheboygan soon. Ronnie, one of the things that pleases me most is our friendship continues even though I'm no longer connected with baseball. It is friends like you that make me feel that everything that happened was worthwhile. I hope we do get a chance to see each other soon. It seems when people are as far apart as we are, they have a tendency to forget. I hope we don't. My regards to the family. I hope everything continues to go well. Always, Jackie.
In Jackie Robinson's very first year of eligibility, it was 1962, he was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York.
I feel quite inadequate here this afternoon, but I think a lot of this has been eliminated because today it seems that everything is complete. I never thought at all that I would have this wonderful honor coming to me so early in my lifetime, and to have the writers to elect me on the first time is a thrill that I shall never forget. We have been up in cloud nine since the election. I don't ever think I'll come down.
Jackie Robinson's friend and my guest today, Ron Rabinowitz, will also be in Cooperstown at the Baseball Hall of Fame today. In fact, he's there this week to share those letters that he was reading and to tell his story. Ron Rabinowitz lives now in Minneapolis. You can read more about him and his connection to Jackie Robinson. Just go to our website at thestory.org. And if you have your own suggestions of stories, we're always open to listening to you. In fact, some of the best suggestions are the ones that come straight from you. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.